In the studio this morning, I have Alan Weir, a New Zealander who is a consultant for peace and disarmament. He is currently a consultant at large for the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. He is outreach educator for the Aotearoa New Zealand Foundation for Peace Studies, global coordinator of the Parliamentary Network for Nuclear Disarmament, and consultants for the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms. So with that quite horrendous introduction, I say kia ora and good morning, Alan.
Kia ora, Tim. Thanks a lot for inviting me on the program.
Alan, we in New Zealand, of course, we're keen to be nuclear free. We, in many ways, wanted to see it exported way back in 1986 as an expression of how New Zealand could affect the world. So where is the nuclear disarmament at present?
I think a key thing in New Zealand is that, as you said right at the beginning of your introduction, nuclear weapons appear to be out of sight and out of mind at the moment. And while most of us know, hey, we're nuclear free and think, well, that's a good thing. I mean, nuclear weapons are, as you say, mad. The fact that we don't see them coming into our ports, we don't see them on the TV news very much, except for the possible, you know, rogue states that are the spotlight has shone on. We don't know that there are these 20-odd thousand nuclear weapons. About 5,000 of them are on hair trigger alert. That means they are prepared to be fired within minutes. It was supposed to be the end of the Cold War. It's still happening. There is still mistrust between some of the key powers. There are still conflicts that could emerge into a nuclear conflict. But sort of we're a long way away from it down in New Zealand. And so I think it's actually important for us to shine the spotlight on these hidden nuclear weapons and on the policies. The United States shines a spotlight on Iran. That's not the most threatening at the moment. I mean, there are other countries, as you mentioned. You know, there are 9 countries probably with nuclear weapons. Some of them are in conflict situations. India and Pakistan have a conflict over Kashmir. It went hot and very nearly went into a full-scale war a couple of years ago, at which stage it probably would have gone nuclear. We were very, very close just a few years ago to a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. There are other conflicts. South China Sea, big conflict there at the moment over resources. We hear, you know, China is concerned over what might happen in Taiwan. The United States supports Taiwan. There is a possibility that could emerge in a conflict that might go nuclear. What's most frightening, though, is that the nuclear weapon states, led by the United States, are expanding their doctrine. You talked about MAD, mutually assured destruction. Well, actually, the policy has gone from MAD to NUTS, nuclear use and tactics, NUTS, N-U-T-S. The nuclear weapon states are now not just saying, oh, the nuclear weapons are there to prevent an attack from another nuclear weapon state. Now they're talking about the threat or use of nuclear weapons against the possible development of chemical weapons or biological weapons or unforeseen development in conventional weapons. They are becoming, in the minds of some of the military planners, another weapon to be used in war, just like another weapon, but slightly bigger and maybe useful for certain military strategies, such as maybe there's some terrorists, as they call them, hidden in bunkers underground, and we need a nuclear weapon to be able to destroy, you know, underground bunker. This sort of thinking is coming into the military. We're not totally aware of it, and we need to be more aware of it because it's very dangerous, even though we don't see it.
It's really overwhelming. I mean, mums at home with their kids just want to take care of the family, and then this umbrella behind the scenes of manipulation. How do we find ways to neutralize this? I remember many years ago we wanted to have New Zealand as a neutral peacemaker. And I know that we have, in the case of Norway went in and tried to bring the Palestinians and the Israelis together. And now they've been involved with the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankans. New Zealand could actually up its profile a lot more in this field, could it not?
Yeah, you talked about perhaps, you know, exporting New Zealand's nuclear-free policy, and I think that's a very good product to export, actually, in a very dangerous world. You know, our nuclear weapon-free zone has been a shining light of sanity. And I think, you know, New Zealanders are proud of it when we travel, because it does demonstrate that we are taking a sane approach. I mean, nuclear weapons are insane. I mean, it's... It's mutual suicide in a sense. It's like, you know, people in a cellar of a house, the cellar is full of petrol and they've got matches. And say, oh, look, I've got so many matches. Watch out, you know, if you get more, I'll get more. Nuclear weapons are like that. If they were ever used, it would break that fire break between the horror of war and the devastation of total destruction of the world, basically. I mean, even if it didn't destroy it straight away, the radiation from the nuclear weapons that are created, the opening up to use of weapons of mass destruction to that degree would create incredible chaos. And civilization, as we know it, would break down. I know that sounds like a bit paranoid, but it's actually the reality of what these weapon systems are. It's why we have people who were formerly engaged in military planning, even engaged in nuclear weapons, like Robert McNamara, who's the former Secretary of Defense for the United States. He was the architect of the MAD policy, the idea of deterrence. At that stage, he believed that that was what was protecting the United States from world war with the Soviet Union. He now says it's madness. We can't continue with such a policy. If we continue with this policy of nuclear threat and use, they're going to be used and it's going to be devastating. So he spoke at the United Nations recently just on that, saying we have to change. Now's the time to move towards nuclear disarmament. But the thing to think about here is not just that nuclear weapons are madness, but we now have the possibility to eliminate them and to verify that other countries are doing it. And I think that's the Chinese symbol for crisis is also the same symbol for opportunity. And that's what we have now. We have the capacity to develop international treaties, to be able to verify them. We can have like satellites watching over to check that a country is abandoning its nuclear weapons. We can have inspection teams going in under the United Nations. We can have international teams which will destroy the current arsenals of nuclear weapons and see that it's happening. And we have an example of that happening. The United Nations disarmed the weapons of mass destruction of Iraq. And this was a dictatorship, and yet the United Nations managed to go in. It took a little while. It didn't happen straight away. But they did dismantle them. They reported that back to the United Nations. Of course, we then had the lies from the US and the UK saying, oh, well, we've got different information saying that Iraq still has weapons of mass destruction. But the United Nations actually did a very, very good job. So we could do that. If the key states decided, yes, we will join in international negotiations for the elimination of nuclear weapons, we could achieve it. Now, back to New Zealand, because that's the question you asked. You know, what about, you know, someone at home who doesn't know the big leaders in the world, isn't over at the United Nations? Are there things that we can do to make this happen? Well, yes, there are. That's the beauty now also of the communication systems and the global political systems that we're developing. And also that we can use our local authorities. There's now a wonderful campaign called Mayors for Peace. 1,300 mayors around the world have joined up. It's led by Mayor Akiba, the mayor from Hiroshima, and one of the vice presidents is the mayor from Nagasaki. Those are the two cities in Japan where nuclear weapons were used. We've got mayors in New Zealand. 27 mayors in New Zealand have joined Mayors for Peace. What they're saying is that any use of nuclear weapons would affect cities. Regardless of whether a bomb is dropped on Auckland or whether it's dropped in Tokyo or dropped in Washington, regardless of where a nuclear bomb is used, the effects would be calamitous. And so cities have a role to prevent the use of nuclear weapons. Mayors and the cities have a role, and we as citizens in a city can work with our mayor to say, okay, participate in the international conferences, conventions, and the events, commemorate them. There's a whole program of events that Mayors for Peace are doing that local people can join in on. So that's one area. But also just as a Kiwi, you know, when you're travelling and spreading the message of our example, it's a very, very good one because a lot of people sort of have fear to move into the unknown. And New Zealand did that. We moved into the unknown of prohibiting nuclear weapons by legislation, complete prohibition. It was a wonderful move. But I know when that happened, because I was involved in the peace movement back in the early 80s, there was a lot of fear. You know, there were a lot of people going, oh dear, will we be unprotected? Might we be attacked? You know, what might happen? What about our trade? There were a lot of fears. Luckily, we had enough confidence to overcome the fears and to move into what was the sane policy. And it worked. I think we're probably more secure than we were then. We're not like a target now. You know, we're not threatening a country with harbouring nuclear weapons here, so no country would feel that threatened, feel we need to be a target for that. It hasn't been bad for our trade. I think actually people overseas say, oh, clean, green New Zealand, you know, they're sort of more favourable to it. So we can be an example to other countries and other people to go, even if you do have some fears, go through it, work through, overcome the fears, leap into the new sort of faith for a new world, where a world based on collaboration and working together rather than one based on threatening each other.
Yes, well, trust and goodwill. New Zealand has got a very good name, really, with trust and goodwill. Most countries, be it third world or the first, and, of course, everywhere, really, New Zealand's got a good name. We sort of sullied it a bit with the last GE conference, where we were keen to sort of be involved in allowing GE to be taken into the third world, but essentially we've got a good name. So
I've travelled around the world a lot. A lot of times it's for, you know, peace work, but often I'm just walking down the streets. Every time I say I'm a New Zealander, people, oh, New Zealand, oh, wonderful, peaceful country.
They're green.
They often know about the nuclear ban. I've even met like a few people who were pretending they were Kiwis because they were treated much better as they were travelling. But yes, we do have a very good image. It means that New Zealand can actually play a very significant role. Even though we're a small country, we play a significant role in the United Nations in the disarmament negotiations and human rights activities because of our good image overseas. And so we can use that to have an incredible effect. And I've seen that in place where New Zealand has helped, for example, take a case to the World Court against nuclear weapons, which a lot of people thought would be very, very difficult. The World Court is part of the United Nations. The key parts of the Security Council and the General Assembly and the World Court, or otherwise known as the International Court of Justice. And the idea to take nuclear weapons to the World Court came from New Zealand, from a retired Judge Harold Evans, who just died recently, unfortunately, but a wonderful legacy that he created. And when we first went over to the United Nations and started talking with other people, we want to take nuclear weapons to the World Court, a lot of people said, oh, you'll never do it, because you're going against the five permanent members of the Security Council. The five most powerful countries in the United Nations are the five declared nuclear weapon states. They'll veto it, they'll block it, they'll, you know, convince others not to do it. They'll put, you know, trade threats and stuff, which they did. But the sentiment against nuclear weapons and the fact that nuclear weapons are so immoral and so insane meant that we could build support from a lot of countries and get a case to the World Court. It was the biggest case in the history of the World Court. We got a wonderful decision from the court that nuclear weapons are illegal, that their threat or use would be against the laws of warfare. Now, one should think that, well, war should be abolished. You know, I mean, that's horrible. And it virtually is. But it still allows sort of, you know, war and self-defense. But even when a war is happening, there are constraints. You know, you're not allowed to kill civilians. You're not allowed to just target cities. Military targets are legitimate in war. Others aren't. Nuclear weapons would violate all those wars because they're indiscriminate. They will cause long-term suffering and damage the environment over many, many generations. So the court came down basically saying, yeah, nuclear weapons would violate the laws of warfare, and countries have an obligation to negotiate for their elimination. And New Zealand led that, and it was, as I said, against the most powerful countries in the world. That's just one example. There are other examples also of where a small country can do something great. There's more that we could do. And it's up to New Zealanders to encourage the government to keep it up and to keep doing more.
Yes, the key is for us, the government are our representatives, and we can't have the government lead. We have to actually prompt them to do to follow through.
Well, they need us to do it. I know, like, when we first declared New Zealand a nuclear-free zone, we got a lot of flack from the United States government, from the Australian government, from the United Kingdom government. And as I mentioned, there are a lot of people who have said, oh, dear, you know, does that mean we're anti-US or we're anti the United Kingdom? And David Longley would get up in Parliament and say, well, some people are saying we're anti the United States, but I actually got 50 letters today from US citizens saying, good on you, you know, you're supporting sanity. And that was very, very important. Also, the fact that we had, at that time, people declared their cities nuclear weapon free zones. so that when Labor drafted its anti-nuclear legislation, it wasn't a Labor Party policy initiative. It was an initiative which had come from the people of New Zealand. We had over 75% of New Zealanders by that time had lived in city councils or county councils that had declared themselves nuclear free. So that was important. So it's important also to keep that up. We need to keep thanking the government when it does good things and getting on their toes if we don't think they're doing enough.
You know, as an Australian, Australia has nuclear-free Brisbane, but it's more overridden by the national government in Australia. This is the problem. The people in Australia, in many cases, in certain instances, wanted to have a nuclear-free city, but, again, didn't have the firepower behind them to get it through, which is a great pity. With neutral countries like Sweden or Austria, is there any initiatives coming from them to assist us? Because in a neutral country, you could possibly have a better say. Is there anything going in that arena?
Well, New Zealand works in coalition with a number of other countries on some nuclear disarmament initiatives. And one was called the New Agenda Coalition. And that included Sweden was one of those countries. The other countries were Ireland, Brazil, Mexico, South Africa. And that was like a very good initiative because collectively with other countries, you can have a stronger imprint on the nuclear disarmament process. And basically, they got the nuclear weapon states to agree that there was an obligation to work for the elimination of nuclear weapons. But that was in 2000. Then the administration changed in the United States, and they walked back away from those obligations. Now the United States doesn't really accept that it's got that obligation. That's the administration. So it's important for New Zealand to work with some of those other countries. But it's also important for us to look beyond the governments because, as I said, you know, the US administration has walked away from its obligations, but there are a lot of people in the United States who agree that with a proposal for the elimination of nuclear weapons. In fact, public opinion polls have showed around about 80% of Americans think there should be the abolition of nuclear weapons. Their leadership, though, isn't reflecting that. So as people, as citizens, we can work with citizens in these countries and support them. We can work with the mayors in the United States who are part of Mayors for Peace. We can support them. We can work with the parliamentarians or the US Congress members, for example. And so I'm coordinating a global network of parliamentarians. It's across political parties. In New Zealand, we have a section of it, which is chaired by Nick Smith, who's from National. The secretary is Keith Locke, who's a Green MP. And we have MPs from all the political parties in the group. And we're now working with some of the Congress members in the United States who would like to see progress on nuclear disarmament. We can support them. We can encourage them. We can give them, you know, the examples and the experience and the arguments to use when they're trying to convince their colleagues in the Congress. And we've had some successes in the U.S. Congress now. It was very difficult straight after September 11th. The U.S. Congress was basically not saying boo to the U.S. administration. But more recently, they're starting to challenge the U.S. administration. They're starting to challenge the Iraq occupation. They're starting to challenge some of the most obscene of the nuclear weapon systems. For example, the U.S. Congress, from committees chaired by Republicans, refused to fund a request from the administration in the U.S. for something called the bunker buster bombs. I referred to these earlier. These are nuclear-tipped weapons which would sort of try and drill underground a little bit and blow up bunkers. Now, the chair of the Republican committee, which provides the funds for this, and said, we're not going to give the funds to Bush to do it, even though it was a Republican chair. He said, I don't want to like give these funds to a nuclear weapon, which seems obvious it's going to be used. He believes that nuclear weapons, if there was a role, the role is just deterrence. And he saw these new developments of nuclear use and tactics as being very, very dangerous. So not all Republicans support Bush on the most, you know, obscene of these policies. And we can work with some of them. And we can, of course, work with some of the Democrats there. But not just in the US. I mean, we also need to work with parliamentarians like Pakistan and India, you know, to make sure that if a crisis rises up again there, they don't think about the nuclear option, which is very important. Or, you know, we work with parliamentarians in the United Kingdom. So these are just some of the things that we can do.
Excellent. I'm really glad to hear that there's this change happening in the States. Now, the United Nations, as a medium to be able to assist in the elimination of nuclear weapons. How does America see the United Nations in relationship to this? Because there's lots of Americans are very sort of wary of the United Nations. Can you shed a bit of light on this?
Yes, well, again, there's a difference between the administration's approach to the United Nations, the US government's approach, and the perspectives of, I would think, a majority of the people. There's an organization called the United Nations Association. In fact, it's active in most countries in the world.
Here in Auckland too.
Very good branch here. Very good branch here in New Zealand. Well, there's a very good branch in the United States. It's very popular. There's a lot of support. Again, there are public opinion polls on the United Nations. There is majority support for the United Nations from the people. Now, there is some misinformation about the United Nations in the US, which skews the perceptions a little bit. There is a feeling in the US that there's too much bureaucracy in the United Nations, that it wastes money. But if you actually have a look, the United Nations budget, the main budget for the whole of the United Nations, which is dealing with poverty, with development, with environment, with human rights, with disarmament, you know, it's a huge amount all over the world. Its main budget is less than the budget of the New York Police Force. So if you're looking at, you know, heightened bureaucracy, I don't think you should really point the finger at the United Nations. Now, I've spent a lot of time over in New York because I was doing a lot of work, advocacy work, education work, collaboration work with some of the United Nations agencies, particularly the Disarmament Agency. And I know the people working, a lot of the people working there, very hard working. They work long hours. They're there because their heart is in it. They have a vision for a world of collaboration and cooperation, a vision where conflicts are solved through peaceful means. That's why they're there at the United Nations. Now, sure, there's one or two who go there because, oh, New York would be a lovely place to live and maybe I can get a job there. Of course you'll have a few like that. But in general terms, it's a very, very good organisation, and it is cost effective, but that finger pointing has shone the light on the United Nations, and it's basically because they, you know, various people didn't want the light shone on some of their own practices within their own countries. The United States is not the only one to do it. There are other countries which have governments that might have their own secrets. They don't want the light shone on that, so they blame somebody else. And unfortunately, that some of that propaganda has stuck in the US. But even though it has stuck, and there is some feeling, well, maybe, you know, there's a little bit too much bureaucracy there, people in the US still support the United Nations.
Yes, I've got Alan Weir, who's a peace and disarmament consultant. And Alan, what are the challenges at the moment? There's many. But can you tell us how the United Nations, is it a possibility that we can use its tools or its capacity to assist and bring disarmament into being?
Yes, it won't take just the United Nations. I mean, the United Nations is not a global government. It's not something which can dictate to countries what happens. And in a sense, that's some fear that some countries have. Oh, United Nations, it'll come and tell us what to do and maybe even take over our country. It's not that. The United Nations is, in a sense, it's like a talk shop where governments, supported by peoples, and there's a role for people in the United Nations, can then develop the international norms and the law through agreements. So it's based on, you know, treaties, declarations of agreement, things like that. But then once there's an agreement there, you then develop the mechanisms for implementing those agreements, including making sure people keep to what they say they're going to do. That's an important part of international law and international treaties. And so the United Nations is the forum where you can develop this. It's where we can come together with the country and say, look, we think that we should develop agreements on nuclear weapons, for example, on disarmament. We want you to join with us in that. We'll do our bit, but you need to do your bit too. And then let's get an agreement to abolish nuclear weapons, and that agreement will provide the mechanism for doing it and provide verification. And also, if someone's cheating, you know, what you do about it, how you can ensure compliance. But we'd agree to it. It's not something that would be imposed. So that's sort of where the United Nations can come in. We can propose ideas. We can set up the negotiations. But it's not enough. Because we've done this at the United Nations. We've got the World Court saying nuclear weapons are illegal, and I mentioned that's one element of the United Nations. We've got the General Assembly, which is where every country has one nation, one vote. They've voted time and time again on nuclear disarmament, but the nuclear weapon states haven't joined the negotiations yet. So that's why we need the political pressure. That's why we need people to get their mayor to take a stronger role in Mayors for Peace to encourage to build this around the world, because that will really help. That's why we need people to encourage their parliamentarian to be play an active role in the parliamentary network on nuclear disarmament and to take parliamentary actions, which will then encourage people and parliamentarians in other countries to do the same. And that will all help the United Nations process.
Yes, a lot of people don't realise that it's like IATA, the International Air Transport Association. It allows all aeroplanes to fly globally, and they all communicate on the same frequency, and they have a language. Everybody knows everything, so that wherever they are, a plane can touch down, providing it's got permission, in any country. It's like the law of the sea. You have all the different laws of the sea, or all the different languages, etc., but they can all actually understand when they want to go anywhere. It's like fax machines. If it wasn't way back, the United Nations led by saying all fax machines have to be able to communicate with every other fax machine on the planet. Now, if it wasn't for them, we would have trouble, like if you've got a Macintosh computer and you can't communicate with a Microsoft computer. There's all sorts of problems, but the United Nations were able to bring out one single method of communication so that we can actually communicate our oneness, I guess.
Yeah, most international agreements and international law are basically to facilitate positive activities amongst people, and here are we between countries. And that's what you don't really hear much about, because when there's a conflict or a war, it's big news. When the United Nations does something like you mentioned, you know, integrating the fax systems or integrating international postal systems or the airways, you know, so the planes will fly without crashing into each other when they go from one country airspace to another, those things, they don't really make the big news. When things are working very well because of all the UN systems in place, they don't make big news. When, you know, the United Nations agency, the World Health Organization, you know, virtually eliminated smallpox, it wasn't really sort of big news. When they came up with oral rehydration therapy, which was this very, very cheap way of saving millions of lives a year, this is because with children, if they don't have sufficient nutrients and they get diarrhea, then they basically can't get any fluid into their body. And so they die from dehydration. That was like the biggest killer amongst children a few years ago. Then up came the oral rehydration therapy, and that was administered through UNICEF, United Nations Children Fund, and that saved millions of lives around the world, but it wasn't big news. So we don't hear the good news stories. Often all we hear about is the scandal where some money was, the UN scandal, where some money was somehow diverted from the Iraq weapons, you know, food for oil program, should I say. And that was like huge news. And yeah, that wasn't a good thing that scandal happened. But yeah, we don't weigh that up against all the good things. So I think with the UN, is there is the potential for more there. It's, in a sense, I mentioned the funding for it is about the same as the New York Police Force. We could put more resources into the United Nations, and it would be even more effective in solving conflicts. It would be even more effective in solving some of the global problems. But the key thing to doing that is looking at what our priorities are. The world spends about $1 trillion a year on the military. About 10% of that redirected towards development would enable adequate food for everybody, clean water, medicine, housing, education. It wouldn't happen instantly because it takes a little while to develop. You know, it would take a number of years, but that's the resources which would be required. Only 10% of the military budget. That's what we need to be thinking about, where we're putting our resources so we can actually facilitate the solving of the world's problems. We have the international mechanisms to be able to facilitate it. Now we just need the resources and the political will to do it.
And the challenges. How do we get, say, the Israelis on board? How do we work through the Republican Party, I guess, and through Congress to get the Americans to come on and say, well, look, we've really got to. If everybody did a 50% reduction under the auspices of neutral observers, well, after that's completed, there would be exactly the same space, but just with less weapons.
Yeah, I think a key thing in terms of like how do you move from one type of social political framework to another is that it's not just one thing. It's not just one leader coming along and suddenly seeing the light. It's people-to-people actions. It's everybody becoming involved in this. It's the small actions that each of us can do. It could be anything, you know, seeing something that you think would be worthwhile and writing a letter to the editor about it, you know, or writing to your mayor or to your parliamentarian, talking with your friends about things, supporting some of the organisations which are working for this, whether it be a peace organisation or a development organisation, a little bit more support for that, you know, from each of us will help. And collectively, things then multiply. If it's only one person doing something, we're not going to get social change. If it's us collectively working, we are going to get social change. We'll change the norm, the way of thinking. We'll change the way things are done by people working together on it. So it's up to us as an individual to do something. And it doesn't really matter. I won't recommend exactly what each person should do. It's up to each person to think, what can I do? What's good for me? You know, I might be an artist, so I might think about doing, you know, some art. I might be a musician, so I might write it into a song or put on a concert. It's really up to us individually what we think is the best way we can contribute to this process.
You're involved with the lawyers in bringing about disarmament, and I feel very happy to hear that lawyers are involved in using their collective power to bring about peace. Could you tell us a little bit more about them? Are they in New Zealand as well as every other country?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before about international law, you know, law is basically a way of facilitating ways of getting things done between people. And so it's part of negotiating agreements, then making sure everybody understands what the agreement is, and then making sure it's clear and precise so people know what they're doing. Sometimes lawyers get so far into the precision that the language gets a little bit lost on ordinary people. And that's a bit of a problem. But in a sense, what they're trying to do is make sure that it's accurate so that when there's disputes, you know sort of what you're doing. So it's a very important aspect of it, but it's just one aspect of the process. But in bringing in lawyers on this, we are engaged in things like, well, for a start, the World Court case against nuclear weapons. The law was important to show that the threat or use of nuclear weapons violates existing law, and that helps develop political pressure. Then the lawyers were involved in drafting a model nuclear weapons treaty. That is, to demonstrate that it's possible to eliminate nuclear weapons, the lawyers, with advice from technicians who know nuclear weapons, disarmed experts who know the political process, they drafted a treaty which shows how you could eliminate nuclear weapons, how you could ensure that countries would comply with it, what you would do about individuals, you know, criminal aspects to it, to make sure that if an individual is involved in something, then they would also be culpable. And this is very important, for example, if war crimes are committed, you know, by a country. You can't just say, oh, it was the country that did it. You say, no, there were people who actually did that, and that's a war crime. And so we now have, you know, an international criminal court. We had Milosevic from Serbia in a tribunal. We've got others in that tribunal. We have those who are responsible for Rwanda being tried in tribunal. Say it's not just, you know, an amorphous government. It's individuals who made that policy happen. So it's the same sort of thing with nuclear weapons. We have to say, look, if anyone ever gave an order to use a nuclear weapon, that is a criminal act. And that person should know now that that's a criminal act and that there would be repercussions if they ever did that. And if they know beforehand the criminal atrocity that would be, then that would be part of like a hesitation to using it. And just to give you an example, that this would actually be so, a friend of mine was talking with Robert McNamara the other day. This is the former US Secretary of Defense. And he's talking about Vietnam, because Robert McNamara was instrumental in some of the US policies against Vietnam. But then afterwards, he sort of recanted, said, well, look, what we did was a mistake, because there was carpet bombing of villages. There was, like, you know, massacre of innocent civilians in the Vietnam War. And my friend asked Robert McNamara, so what do you think about, you know, an international criminal court? Would it have any effect on the United States? I mean, it seems as though, you know, the administration doesn't pay any attention to international law. You know, what would it be if there was an international criminal court at the time of Vietnam? Would it have had any difference? And McNamara said, yes, it would have had a difference. And my friend was actually surprised. He thought the answer would have been the opposite. You know, no, the US doesn't pay any attention to these. And he said, it would pay a difference. And he said, yes, you know, at the time, when we're thinking, there's a political framework that we're making our decisions. And if you know that one of those acts could be a crime, even if it doesn't seem as though you could be personally charged because your country refuses to accept it, there is still, like, in your mind this, oh, that is illegal. Oh, there could be repercussions. Oh, I really better think about that act again. So it is, even though it's a weak court, that we've got an international criminal court at the moment, and it is weak at the moment, it's an incredible move. I mean, it's only new. We never had this in the past. Now, dictators are starting to rethink what they're doing, and that's very, very important. We're actually getting dictators being taken to court now. I mentioned Milosevic, that was one, but also Pinochet has been taken to court from Chile, you know, for the crimes that were committed of torture. So, yeah, there definitely is, you know, things that can move along those lines. And the lawyers are very important in helping that happen, but they can't do it by themselves. They're, again, facilitators. Again, it has to be popular support for these sorts of things to happen.
Yes, it shows that our society, our civilization is evolving, that we are, these laws now are getting very, very specific and clear, making sure that the kings or the despots of hundreds of years ago who could get away with anything just can't get away with it anymore.
Oh, yes. And I think what the evolving is happening is into, I would say, multiple levels of authority. And that's important because we're not moving towards a world government which is going to tell everybody what to do, but we are moving towards greater global governance. What that means is there's a lot more interaction at the international level, and there has to be, because if we don't, the global corporations are just going to, like, do whatever they want. You know, they're going to do their slave labor rates. They're going to wreck the environment. We need global governance. We need international law. But we also need authority at other levels, at local levels. We need authority at the city level. Even, you can even go beyond that. I mean, we have to have authority in our own family, for example, you know. So that, and the city doesn't take over from the authority of a family. Neither does a national authority take over from city authority. We have multiple levels of authority. It seems a little bit complex, but it's actually not that complex. You know, it's actually realizing that we are living in different arenas, and that different arenas have different mechanisms, and that they all work together, and they need to be consistent. And the consistency we're looking for is a world based on non-violence, on cooperation and collaboration, whether that be in the family, you know, a more democratic families that are non-violent and conflicts are solved, you know, without violence in the family, or whether it be in our community where we have inter-ethnic misunderstandings and we need to sort those out and learn from each other, sort out those conflicts without violence, or whether it means nationally or internationally. The same principles, the same types of mechanisms, they just operate at different levels.
Yes, it definitely shows that we can work together. All we have to do is be open to communicating, and falling back on this whole thing of New Zealand and trust and goodwill. Our country as a whole is a good, honest country, and we need to be able to see our brothers and sisters over the horizon, mm-hmm. and open dialogue, which brings me to citizen diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And of course, essentially, you're a citizen diplomat. And I remember at the time I was in Russia in 1986, and Gorbachev had just got in, and Perestroika was there, and Glasnost. And outside the Lenin's tomb at midnight, I turned around to this person, and he was sort of covered up, and asked him who he was. I said, "Are you Steve Wozniak of Apple Computer?" And he says, "How do you know? How do you know?" And anyway, after a while I got through. He had been on a peace march from Leningrad to Moscow, and so you... And then I heard of many others. A woman called Dixie Belcher from Alaska had been over there with a whole group of people working with the Russians. And then Spock, or Leonard Nimoy of Star Trek, he was there with another group. And there were just many, many different groups of people just going to different countries and wanting to open up diplomacy, so that just at family level.
The citizen diplomacy is so important because it's easier to accept going to war with people you don't know. It's much harder if you know them. There's this wonderful movie that came out at Christmas time, La Joie Noire, and it was about the 1914 incident on the front line in the First World War, where the Germans started playing some music and the Scottish on the other side heard it, so they sort of joined in, and then the French contingent joined in. And then they suddenly realized, oh, hold it, we're sharing something. They put down their guns, they came across, met each other, celebrated Christmas together, played a game of soccer together. After that, they couldn't fight. They didn't want to shoot these people because they knew them. They'd talked about cafes that they both knew about in Paris, for example. That's the sort of thing. That's what helped break down the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the US, was these citizen diplomacy efforts, so that people didn't want to have a nuclear war against each other. That's what's important for Palestine and Israel. They need to have more connection between the people, meeting together, playing sports together, playing music together, to realize we share more than we're different. We do have differences, but we also share a lot as common humans with similar ideas, similar visions, similar dreams for our future. And if we get that and realize we share these things, we're less likely to want to kill each other.